Hello, and welcome to Runway Girl Network in Conversation, a deep dive into aviation and the passenger experience. I'm RGN Deputy Editor John Walton, and today I'm in conversation with Michelle Robson of premium travel blogger Turn Left for Less, and a former air traffic controller, no less. This episode, we're talking about what's new in business class, with a focus on the UK market. But first, thanks to our sponsor. In Conversation is brought to you by Bolteron, a Simona company, purveyor of high-performance thermoplastics for tomorrow's aircraft interiors. Specialising in an extensive range of film and sheet products tailored to the requirements of the aerospace industry, Bolteron is dedicated to providing consistent, high-quality materials, advanced performance solutions, and meeting evolving trends in aircraft interior design. Learn more at boltaron.com. Now, Michelle, welcome to the podcast. What an interesting time it is in the pointy end of the plane.
It certainly is. There's a lot going on at the moment, and thanks for having me on.
Oh, not at all. So you write a lot about business class. What do you think about where we are in the industry at the moment? Is business class in a position of strength? Is it being challenged by premium economy? Does the continuing long-drawn-out tea time of the soul for first class affect what airlines are doing with business class? What's your overall perspective?
Well, I think it's quite interesting at the moment. There's been quite a few articles with people saying that business class is pretty much on the way out because of premium economy. But I think that's really about the corporate end of the market, which people tend to focus on. Obviously, there's a huge amount of money there. And nowadays, it's very rare, unless you're very senior, to actually get anything other than premium economy. I think the airlines have previously focused on corporate customers a lot more, but now they're having to think differently, whereas the area of growth is more on the leisure side. I think with this, they need to start looking at how leisure travellers think rather than just focusing on the corporate side. Personally, I'm more of a leisure traveller, though kind of with the blog, it combines both. But they either have to be won over on price, which we are actually seeing some really interesting fares at the moment that are, you know, pretty much premium economy prices, or you have to have a superior product. But a lot of places like British Airways perhaps are going more for the cheaper end to try and win the leisure travellers over rather than necessarily investing in the product.
Yeah, I find that really interesting, and particularly in the context of BA having what isn't, let's say, the most competitive product out there in terms of their hard seating product either.
Yeah, I think British Airways, if you look at some of the fares at the moment, they're really, really quite astonishing, and they're obviously going after leisure travellers. So you're seeing fares of around £1,200-£1,300 return in business class to the US, but they're 6 month advance fares, which means, you know, that's not going to be a corporate traveller, but they are trying to win back their leisure customers, because it's quite interesting. On the blog, I obviously get a lot of feedback and comments, and one of the most consistent one is from British Airways travellers with status, and nearly all of them will say once they have gained their status, they will take their business elsewhere in Oneworld because of the lack of a good product on board. But obviously, if the price is right, then you're going to go back to British Airways, and that's what they're banking on.
Yeah, and I'm finding it interesting. There's a lot of these fares, particularly the, I guess, the super advanced fares that are 6 months out. They're very restricted on days and times, right? So it's you're Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, to avoid, melting the bread and butter, as it were, of BA's transatlantic routes, which is that sort of club world business class on the high demand business class days.
Yes, they're all pretty much, as you say, midweek fares, which really doesn't appeal to business travellers or necessarily leisure travellers. But they also have a restriction on having to stay a Saturday night or 7 days normally, which is definitely more on the leisure side. But I think most people that are leisure travellers can work with it. If it's cheap enough, let's face it, you're going to travel on a Tuesday rather than a Saturday if it actually saves you £1,000.
Yeah, and I think that a lot of this is also driven by aging demographics. You have baby boomers sort of ending up, you know, in the retirement stage of their lives right now. Lots of them will have flown extensively in there during their careers. And, you know, I know my parents, having flown internationally, a lot of it in economy, once they reached their retirement age, they said, actually, we're not going to do long haul economy for holidays anymore. You know, we prioritize a bit of comfort and a bit of relaxation and a good night's sleep, rather than, you know, when we were young, sitting up all night and in an economy class chair.
I think you're right. There's definitely in the retirement sort of sector, there's definitely a big push towards more premium travel, because people, you know, they have their pension now and they think, well, we've got the time, we can fly whenever we want, we can get a good fare, and, you know, I don't want to suffer economy. And once the problem, once you actually get into business class, you never want to go back. That's the thing. You can't go back to economy after that. But I think the other thing that's influencing a lot, and I would say this given my job, is actually the internet and bloggers and places like Flyer Talk, because the fares are much more visible nowadays. You can see that you can get a much cheaper fare. Whereas before, people wouldn't have even thought about business class. They just would have assumed it was too expensive.
Yeah, and I find that really interesting in terms of if you are, you know, one of the mobile, vocal and social passengers that we talk about all the time on RGN, you can get an incredible deal. But I also wonder if you know that you can get a £1,200-1,400 return flight to the States, does that take out some of the, the more price sensitive end of the market, who perhaps, you know, might have been willing to pay a little bit more, and then they think, oh, well, actually, no, business class is really only worth £1,400 rather than, you know, before it might have been £2,000 or £3,000.
Yeah, I think you're right there. It's influencing some behaviour, but I think there is also a different segment of the market that actually do want to pay more. And I think this is where British Airways have been playing a bit of a dangerous game, in that people are very savvy nowadays. You know, I think the average is something like people will read at least 3 reviews before buying any travel product. So people will look at reviews of business class and they will see that, for example, Qatar has really good seats, and they will say, right, I will pay the extra because actually, you know, to me, it's more value for money to pay a bit extra and actually get a really good product.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm working on something right now around the amount of social media and the amount of investment that airlines are making into making social media Instagram worthy, Instagram friendly vignettes within their product. I mean, I'm thinking here about that Qatar Airways, that little table when you arrive on the plane, and it's got that cushion with either "This is my happy place" or "The sky's a wonderful place to be" printed on in a very on-trend gold. You've got your little bricks amenity kit, you've got your hot towel, you've got your welcome drink, you've got their lovely fuzzy duvet, and you can create your own little sort of Instagram vignette to sort of share with your friends, or to pop on your Facebook or wherever. And I find that really interesting as a thing that airlines are really starting to design now, is to make shareable moments for passengers, which really does help to boost their viewing. You know, it's not just trade press anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. I think they're reaching people that they probably wouldn't have done before. The sort of person that necessarily is on Instagram is probably not going to be reading lots of different blogs, because they're probably not, you know, a frequent traveller enough to bother with it. But it's funny you mentioned the Qatar pillow, because I'm actually sitting here looking at one that says "The sky is a wonderful place," because it sits in my office to remind me of my lovely Q Suite experience. But yeah, I think you're right. Qatar are very, very savvy with their social media and interacting with bloggers, so I think people like British Airways are only just catching on to this, and I think they probably need to up their game a bit more with some of the other airlines.
Yeah, absolutely. So looking at the seats and the hard product side of things, I ranked them all back in January on Runway Girl Network, and you can find that on the site. But the short version is I ranked Q Suite at the top, followed by the Vantage XL product, which is basically the Delta One suites right now. It hasn't really rolled out to anyone else in a big way yet. Then the two herringbones that face outwards towards the windows, the Super Diamond and Cirrus. What do you think of those at the top of the rank? Do those match your and your readers' perspectives on who's running the best business class these days?
I think you're pretty spot on with your list, actually. My favourite business class is Qatar, pretty much, though there is nobody that has the perfect business class for me yet. I still think there's room for improvement. I did the Q Suites recently at the end of May, and I love the overall product. I like all the little touches, like the candle on the table and, as you said, the pillow and the privacy. But actually, for me, it was a little bit hard. The seat, I actually found the Super Diamond seats more comfortable. So it's kind of, if they could just tweak that, then I think that would be pretty much perfect. But I think as an overall product, I would put that as number one. I had a look through your list, actually, and I pretty much agree with it all. I think the only thing that's missing for me there would be the Etihad business studio. I didn't notice that on the list.
Yeah, well, it comes sort of just under the top 10 cutoff, really, largely because of the feeling of space that you get in their old product, which is the Solstice, which ended up as 10th equal. It's that sort of forwards backwards thing that maximizes space for the airline, but still it's just that little bit elbow roomy for me, particularly on the 787 product, and upstairs on the A380. Those smaller cabins and the sort of I guess 8 columns of seats, just that little bit. Just not enough generosity of space there for me compared with some of the other products. But it is a beautiful, beautiful product. They did a great job with that group of design houses in the consortium that they put together. I'd certainly pick that to travel in any day.
Yeah, it's actually one of my favourites. I would probably put it on a par for me with the Super Diamond and the Cirrus. I think because of the extra privacy, that's why I rank it highly. If you get one of the seats that are a window seat with a table on the aisle side, it feels very private. And I think all the little design touches, like the lights with the lattice work on it, it's just a really attractive product.
Yeah, no, definitely on design. And you're absolutely right. If you do get one of those seats that has the extra... the extra privacy, so you've got the little side table between you and the aisle, it's great. But one of the problems with that is that that's only in some of the seats in the cabin. And I call this the zero-sum game, right? So there's only a few seats in the cabin that have that extra privacy. And if you aren't booking far enough in advance, or your seat gets moved by the airline at the last minute, you don't really have any recourse to that. You know, and I've seen, in that sort of staggered seating, I've seen flight attendants literally go flying. One tripped over the foot sticking out into the aisle of someone in front of me. Yeah. Fortunately, she wasn't carrying anything at the time. But I could just imagine that, you know, with a tray of glasses or something raining through the cabin. That zero something is what you're, if you get one of those good seats, they're great. But if you don't, it really does pull down the rating for me, because you can't always count on getting one of the good ones.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think that's how British Airways managed to keep a lot of their frequent flyers. So myself being gold, it means that I can nearly always select one of the more premium seats. For example, that on the upper deck of the 747, there are several seats where you don't climb over anyone. They don't climb over you, and you have good privacy in a window seat. So for me, it actually makes British Airways a much better product than it might be for somebody who has just left it to online checking because they have no status. And I think that's quite clever to actually give your frequent travellers something that's quite a big perk, where they can get those really good seats. So you're rewarding the people that are your best customers.
Yeah, what is it, 62 or 64 A and K, isn't it? Those are my personal favourites there.
Yeah, me too. That's the ones I go for. And similar on the A380, there's a couple of seats that are very similar to that.
Yeah, yeah. So overall then, Michelle, what is your favourite business class?
It's definitely Qatar. I think not just because they do some excellent deals, which there's still a few around of, but it's been a lot less recently. But I think it's just the whole product in the air. I think on the ground, it's not always quite as good. The lounges I like, but in the air, there's a lot of attention to detail. The cabin crew are consistent, which I think is quite often a problem with other airlines. I find Qatar the most consistent out of all the airlines I've flown on. And I've flown with Qatar quite a lot. I think their product is pretty consistent, that they still have the A330 seats and the old 777 seats, which hopefully they'll get rid of soon. And then it will be a lot more consistent with mainly the Q suites. And I think that the food is high quality. It's not as good as some other airlines, but it's consistent quality. You know what you're going to get. And that's what I like is knowing that it's going to be good and it's going to be consistent. And I think Qatar seems to genuinely want you as a customer. Things like the cabin service manager will come up and speak to every passenger. That's quite rare in business class. The person serving you comes up and introduces themselves and talks a little bit about the flight. It's all those sort of personal touches that make it for me.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's I find it so interesting what you say about the old A330 and 777 seats, which is the old BE Aerospace, now Rockwell Collins, mini pod seat, which is your simple fully flat bed in a 222 on the A330, and Qatar puts it as 222 on the 777 as well. I was with a group of non-expert aviation people on a media trip late last year to Chiang Mai in Thailand, as it happens. And it was a lot of Instagram folks. It was a lot of business reporters and a few travel reporters who were very much on the travel side and not on the aviation side. And we flew out to Chiang Mai on one of the newly outfitted A330s, which has the Rockwell Collins Diamond. That's what you'll find in most airlines, 757s, for example, who have a pointy end product. It's a staggered seat, but the stagger, the offset really, means that you don't have as much space between you and the screen in front. But on the return, it was the mini pod seat. And I found it fascinating that without fail, everyone was like, this seat is so spacious, it's amazing, because there's nothing between you and the seat back at the foot of your stretched out bed. And I thought that was really interesting. You know, all of us who live and breathe seats think, oh, just a fully flat bed, it's not a stag or anything, it's not the best. But actually, people see the amount of room and they go, wow. That was really fascinating to me, how people how people perceive things differently, and how those of us who, as I say, live and breathe this stuff, often see things a little bit differently to your average traveller, even experienced and seasoned ones.
Yes, I think you're right there. And also a lot of it is about your travelling style. So personally, I travel a lot solo. So that's why I really don't like the 777 seats, because it's 222, and you have to climb over somebody, which I really hate, or you get an aisle seat, which I hate as well, because I like to look out of the window. Yeah. But you know, for somebody in a couple, then it's absolutely perfect for them. So it just depends on what your personal preference is. But I actually quite like those seats in terms of comfort. They're just, I think you get used to a certain standard of seat, and when you go back to something that's a bit dated, it doesn't seem quite as exciting, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. Moving on to something a little bit less dated, you were on the new Iberia A350 recently, weren't you? But not on the long haul.
No, they've been doing some pilot and crew training between London and Madrid for the last couple of weeks. I think it's just finished at the beginning of the week and started the New York service. So it gave quite a few of the blogging community a chance to try it out before it actually went into service. And I was very impressed, actually.
Yeah, so that's the Stelia Solstice, the latest generation of that good old staggered seat, one of the ones that really kicked off the staggered revolution. How has it changed compared with Iberia's previous business class seat?
It's definitely a step up. I think the main difference for me was the width of the seat. They have increased it, and it was really, really noticeable. Other than probably Singapore, it felt like one of the widest seats I've sat in business class, and I really like that. Certainly lying down, you don't feel like, if you're a side sleeper like me, you don't feel like you're kind of hanging over the edge when you're on your side. So it was a big step up. The screen size is also bigger than the previous version as well. And obviously it's better technology. It was very clear. And I think the handheld remote was actually one of the best I've used as well. It was very responsive. It didn't get that lag you get with a lot of them, and it was very simple to use. So the table was another thing that I noticed, where it was very easy to manoeuvre it. So if you wanted to get out during the meal service, you could actually push it out of the way, which is one of my pet hates on other airlines, where you can't actually get up. You're kind of trapped until they come and take your tray away.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can't help but thinking that this might be one of the seats that British Airways could potentially use to replace its current product, which is produced by Rockwell Collins, if memory serves, and in style really dates back to about 2000 when it introduced it in the Zodiac Aerospace Mohawk. And Mohawk referring to the self-stowing fabric fan between the seats. It then evolved in 2006 to what we see today, roughly with the sort of translucent divider. Do you think that would work for the BA customer market?
I think it could potentially. It certainly has most of the things that they have identified that is missing from the current product. Alex Cruz has talked about his list of, I think it's about 10 or 13 different things on the list that the new seat has to fulfill, with privacy and more storage space and aisle access being the top one. So it ticks all those boxes, apart from maybe the storage. I did notice before takeoff there wasn't really anywhere to put things like a laptop that you were allowed to leave them there. But it would fulfill that, but I don't think that's what they will do, because I don't think it's groundbreaking enough. That's my feeling, having heard Alex Cruz talk about the new seats.
Yeah, so you reckon they'll come up with something entirely new for their fleet-wide business class, do you?
I think they will. I think, you know, Alex is a smart guy. He's identified that they have gone, you know, a long way behind the rest of the market. And I think with the lateness of the new product, they need to do something really groundbreaking that's going to not age. Because at the moment, obviously, they're almost two generations behind with the likes of the suites with Delta and Qatar. So I think they might go for something in that sort of area is my guess. Maybe not a full Q suite, but something with a lot more privacy that's quite different, because I think that's what they need to attract people back. They've had a lot of bad publicity in the last couple of years. They need a real wow factor, in my opinion. And certainly, having heard rumours on things like Flyer Talk, the rumour is that it will be something similar to a Q suite, but with more of a British Airways feel to it.
Yeah, and that would make a lot of sense. I don't think you can lay any claim to be a premium airline these days and not be installing suites in your business class. I think that bar has just been raised, and I think it's really interesting to see what the reaction is from seat makers. I was at the Aircraft Interiors Expo this year, and with apologies to Beyonce, it seemed very much if you liked it, then you should have put a door on it. simply because, you know, everyone was showing an option with, oh yes, and you can bolt on a door as well. That Stelia product that we were just talking about on Iberia, they have an option where you can stick a door on that. And that will work on your A350 and your 777. But once you start going as narrow as a 787 or an A330, that then really starts asking some questions about, do you have that extra 2-3 inches for a door to add to an existing product? Or do you have to do something like Zodiac Aerospace was doing, which was creating a fabric divider that sort of pulls out from the seat side? And that was a really interesting thought, not least because obviously Singapore Airlines debuted the suite in modern times 11 years ago with the A380, and their dividers there were fabric too. If you remember, the doors themselves are thermoplastic and metal and close, but the little windowed parts of the doors are fabric. And I found that a really interesting full circle for premium products in less than 10 years, for us to have gone from suites being from first class to suites being for business class. What's your take? Can BA do something that isn't a suite, or do they have to do something that's really properly got a door on it?
I think they could get away without a door, because actually I think there's probably about a quarter of people don't like the idea of a suite. I hear the comment that it must be very claustrophobic quite regularly from my readers, but I don't find it claustrophobic at all, and I don't particularly like small enclosed spaces. So they could do something that's more of a suite but without the actual door on it. I think the interesting thing for me is more about the density as well, because at the moment they've got a very dense business class with the 242 configuration, and can they actually afford to reduce that? Certainly they've talked about reducing the size of first class to accommodate it, but it will be very interesting interesting to see what density they go for, because, you know, the bottom line is they need to make money out of it.
Well, exactly. I mean, I don't think you can start, you can be offering £1,200, £1,400 business class returns if you've got a less dense product, for example.
I'm pretty sure that they will have to put the prices up, which is the downside to it. I don't think they'll be able to keep offering these sort of fares, but then, you know, that's the price you pay for a better product.
Well, exactly. And of course, that first class question is a really interesting one, because it feels almost as if BA has painted itself into a corner with its first class product, because it is essentially an outward facing herringbone that like most airlines offer in business class in terms of that level of product. Where can BA go in the context of the current first class? I mean, do they have to upgrade it if they go to a more private product with direct aisle access in business, or does that mean the end of first class?
I think it's a really interesting question, because like business class, there's been a lot of talk about is first class on the way out. And then, of course, Singapore and Emirates introduced their new very fancy suites. And that pretty much answers the question for me. I think it's definitely reducing. British Airways have said that they're going to reduce the number of first class seats, as they've already started to do on some routes. And I think that's right, because if you actually look at the loads, a lot of the time, there's not actually that many fare paying passengers, and mainly people that are on redemption tickets. And obviously, you know, they make some money on that, but not the sort of level you need to maintain first class. They certainly need to improve it. And I think they've realised that already, just with the introducing of the white company bedding in business class. They've already got a product there that's pretty much as good as the first offering. So they need to start doing something fairly quickly. Alex, again, has said that he needs to improve the first class product with the improvements in club currently. And I think they're going to go down the Emirates or Singapore type very premium product. I think they'll reduce the number of seats dramatically, stop doing it on a lot of routes, and actually have a really ultra premium product, probably some sort of suite with a door, and hopefully they'll upgrade the onboard offering, because I think although it's good, you know, you have the Laurent Perrier Grand Siecle and the food is okay, but it's nowhere near the sort of level of a lot of the airlines that have the caviar and they have the Krug, and you know, a lot of them been doing small batches of very premium champagnes, which is nice to see. It's something a little bit special, and I think that's where British Airways are missing that special touch. It's all a bit what's the word I'm looking for, all a bit pedestrian, I think, for first class. It doesn't have that wow factor.
Yeah, and you know, look, realizing that we are talking very much about how our diamond shoes are too tight and RTRs are pinching here, I think you're right. That pedestrian feel is particularly present in the soft product. It's solidly British, the food, and some of that's fine, right? Some of that's, you know, some of it's got some interesting modern British stuff, but there's just not enough innovation for me. There's not enough partnering with solid British food brands either, you know, whether that's celebrity chefs or whether that's producers. And no, I also just wrote recently in Upfront about BA's new champagnes. You know, there's six of them, of which four are in the first class branding. And, you know, on board, you've got Grand Siecle, which is fine, but it is still, it's not one of those very top vintage champagnes, and you know, you have airlines that they're competing with offering, you know, proper vintage prestige cuvée champagne, and I'm just I can't help but think that BA, which comes from the world's largest champagne market, which is the UK, and is one of the world's largest buyers of champagne, they have the expertise and they have the access to the market to do that kind of curation that you're talking about, which other airlines do very successfully. Lufthansa, for all its flaws, has a very interesting revolving champagne offering in first class, which is great. The Japanese airlines do too. I've been impressed by the selections on both JAL and ANA. And of course, you know, in the Middle East, you despite the the cultural sensitivities about that, there's good champagne poured frequently on all of those airlines, and I think that BA is missing a trick in applying its knowledge and applying its experience to and indeed its brand heritage. to really create a feeling of a customized signature experience, rather than very cookie cutter kind of first class experience now.
Yes, and I think part of the problem is the sheer number of seats and the fact that you've got a lot of people in the cabin that are actually on Avios redemptions or upgrades with vouchers, etc. So I don't think at the moment they could actually afford to do that and offer the really ultra premium champagnes and wines. But I think if they go down the route that I suspect they will and reduce it to a much more small and premium bespoke type product, I think that's the time they will start to look at the onboard offerings with the champagne and wine, because they'll be able to afford to, you know, they'll be able to charge a premium price compared with what they've been charging recently. And they will have smaller numbers of people that will mean, you know, they can actually source some of the smaller vintages and do that more premium feel to the wine list. As you say, at the moment, it's definitely a bit cookie cutter. Though I am pleased to see that they're actually offering English sparkling wines, because personally speaking, I think a lot of them are just as good as champagne.
Yeah, well, and certainly, you know, talking in terms of wines, that's very much true. You know, with climate change, the actual Champagne region itself is getting hotter, and so that's producing some problems in terms of producing wines in the same style as previously, and all of the restrictions about which grapes you can get and from where. Very much an interesting proposition, and some of those are excellent. I mean, Virgin Atlantic cracked open a few in business class a few years back, and they were really, really good. And sometimes what they lack in, I guess, complexity is not that much of a downside in the air in particular. You know, you don't want it to be too nutty, too biscuity in the air. You want some of those sort of fresh, floral, fruity scents, which I love in the air. That works really well.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm a big fan of English sparkling wine, mainly because I live in one of the wine regions. I'm very close to in Hampshire to several vineyards, and I actually prefer English sparkling wine when I'm flying for exactly the reasons you say. It's I think more refreshing. You feel like you could have a couple of glasses without it starting to get a bit cloying with the more complex French champagnes.
Yeah, it's an excellent excellent sipping bubbles, I think, is the general rule. I think that one of the questions that you end up asking is, how do you design the in-flight menu to take advantage of that? You know, what can you do in terms of offering something that's a little bit lighter, a little bit fresher, that doesn't have a sort of heavy, too much of a heavy sauce to it, for example, that will really work for that.
Yeah, and I think the difficulty with it is there's a lot of people that fly first class that still expect those traditional heavier dishes, but they need to cater for a newer class of traveller that's, you know, wants something lighter in the air and doesn't want to have necessarily the over the top type traditional first class, wants something a bit lighter but a bit special. And I think British Airways did get there for me when they had the A380 initially. They did a really good tasting menu that was you know, excellent, and you didn't have to have the whole thing. If you wanted, you could pick and choose, but they're all quite small, beautifully presented, generally quite light, and that suited me perfectly because you could just have as much or as little as you wanted. And I thought that was a real shame that went, and I hope maybe if they introduce a new first that they'll bring that back.
Yeah, I mean, that's always been a big thing in Qantas first class on the A380, has been the availability of that tasting menu on daytime flights. You know, those are some long flights, and it really helps to both solidify the product offering in first class, and, you know, what the promise is there, but also just to, you know, it helps us showcase you and your airline and the way that your airline's brand works with your country brand as a tourism destination, and that is also, you know, that's really priceless, and that's something I think that BA is going to need to do in future years, is really figure out just how British BA wants to be. But if we think about first class, where does it go from here? Does it become a lounge brand, which, you know, in many ways, I guess it is in some cases at the moment. So, you know, your British Airways first lounge in Heathrow Terminal 5 isn't for BA first class passengers. I see a number of airlines, you know, looking at this in terms of, well, okay, what we will offer as a first class lounge for our few remaining first class passengers on a few remaining first class flights is now our either ultra elite or high elite frequent flyer lounge. Is that what you're seeing as well?
Yeah, I think if you look at the American Airlines, for example, with their dining areas that are just for first passengers, I think that's where it's heading, in that you have something that's just for your elites, because, you know, your gold level, you don't necessarily want to have that many people in a proper first class lounge. So you need that kind of two levels, something for the gold level and then something for people that are actually in first, that's a lot more intimate and can afford to offer the really premium products that you wouldn't necessarily want to offer in something like the BA First Lounge at Heathrow, which is absolutely enormous and has a fair few hundred people in it. You just couldn't afford to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we've seen other airlines do this. Singapore Airlines has both the first class lounge and the private room, which is very exclusive in Singapore Changi. It's by no means the first one to do that. But I think that if it does that, what does it need to offer to passengers? Because the Concorde room, is hitting its 10th year in Heathrow Terminal 5 at the moment. And of course, it doesn't offer a Concorde room when it's Terminal 3 flights, of which there still are, a few long haul options there. What does it need to do to really make a first class lounge for first class passengers versus an upgraded lounge for its top tier frequent flyers?
Well, I think for me, having been in, the Qatar one and the Etihad one, a lot of it is about getting what you want when you want it. And I think that's sometimes where British Airways falls down a bit, particularly with spa appointments, for example, in that you have to book them a long time in advance. So when a first class passenger turns up, you can go to the spa and there's no appointment. Again, we're, first world problems, but you've paid thousands of pounds for a first class product and then you get there and you can't actually get the things that you were looking forward to. So I think making sure it's on demand and you have enough staff to actually get people what they want. I think the things like the cabanas that British Airways have, having something like that that's a private room, ideally for me, with some sort of sleeping area or a chaise longue or something where you can actually lie down, and a personal bathroom, something like the cafe bars that you get, that you can have a soak in, that's always nice. And the dining, it needs to be a proper restaurant atmosphere, a decent menu, plenty of choice. I think that's somewhere that a lot of them fall down on. And of course, the premium champagnes and premium wines.
Yeah, absolutely. Those private areas are fantastic. I always remember there's one redeeming feature to the Air China lounge in Shanghai, which is basically you've got these little sleeping rooms which have their own individually controllable air conditioner. Because Shanghai can be incredibly sticky, and it can be a bit of a madhouse at the airport. There's not a lot of priority processing, and there are numerous screenings because China has particular additional screenings for lithium batteries, or did the last time I was flying through. And so you get to the lounge, and it's quite an open lounge, so it's a bit noisy, and it's not super premium. But just being able to pop into a little room, even if it's for 10, 15, 20 minutes, put the air conditioner on blast, perhaps even have a change of clothes, and just have a little nap, a little bit of quiet, incredibly refreshing. And I think that that's going to be something that airlines in premium classes can really offer to make a difference. I really think that that's a big differentiator that they can provide as part of their offering. A little bit of peace and quiet is something that a lot of people are lacking these days, particularly in airports.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think, unless you've got a suite on board the flight, you do lack that privacy. I think it's if you're very tired and you just want to lie down and close your eyes, you don't want to be in the middle of a lounge. You want to have a private space, or if you're trying to work, for example. I think the problem with a lot of the airlines is actually having enough space in airports. A lot of the airport lounge companies are struggling currently to actually have enough space to cater for all the people that want to come in. So whether whether they can actually afford to do that is a different matter, because then you're giving up space in the general lounge area as a result. So it's an interesting dilemma.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And one I'm sure that we'll be talking about in future conversations. But that's it for today. Listeners, we hope you enjoyed it, and we're always keen to find out what you think. Please feel free to email me at john@runwaygirlnetwork.com with any suggestions at all. Thank you to our guest, Michelle Robson. Where can our listeners find you, Michelle?
So my website is called Turning Left for Less. So www.turningleftforless.com, and I'm also on all the social media, Twitter, Facebook, etc., under the same name.
Excellent. As ever, listeners, you can find me on Twitter at thatjohn, and everything from RGN on Twitter at runwaygirl, and of course at runwaygirlnetwork.com. If you're enjoying these conversations, please leave a rating and review wherever you get your podcasts, and thanks for listening.